and take my sister aside. I know she would have gone, though, no matter the excuse. She still believes that if we do what they want, they'll get bored and leave us alone. Maybe she's right, but I don't care. Tears spill over her cheeks. There is such a deep well of rage inside me.
You're no killer.
I leave my books and cross the grass toward them. Cardin half turns, and I shove him so hard that his back hits one of the trees. His eyes go wide. I don't know what you said to her, but don't you ever go near my sister again, I tell him, my hand still on the front of his velvet doublet. You gave her your word. I can feel the eyes of all the other students on me. Everyone's breath is drawn. For a moment, Cardin just stares at me with stupid, crow-black eyes. Then one corner of his mouth curls.
Oh,
he says.
You're going to regret doing that.
I don't think he realizes just how angry I am, or how good it feels, for once, to give up on regrets. Chapter 9. Taryn won't tell me what Prince Cardin said to her. She insists that it had nothing to do with me, that he wasn't actually breaking his promise not to hold her accountable for my bad behavior, that I should forget about her and worry about myself. Jude, give it up. She sits in front of the fire in her bedroom, drinking a cup of nettle tea from a clay mug shaped like a snake, its tail coiling to make the handle. She has on her dressing gown, scarlet, to match the flames in the grate. Sometimes, when I look at her, it seems impossible that her face is also mine. She looks soft, pretty, like a girl in a painting, like a girl who fits inside her own skin. Just tell me what he said, I press. There's nothing to tell, Taryn says. I know what I'm doing. And what's that? I ask her, my eyebrows lifting, but she only sighs. We've gone 3 rounds like this already. I keep thinking of the lazy blink of Cardin's lashes over his coal-bright eyes. He looked gleeful, gloating, as though my fist tightening on his shirt was exactly what he would have wished. As though, if I struck him, it would be because he made me do it. I can annoy you in the hills and also the dales, I say, poking her in the arm. I will chase you from crag to crag across all 3 islands until you tell me something. I think we could both bear it better if no one else had to see, she says, then takes a long pull of her tea. What? I am surprised into not knowing what to say in return. What do you mean? I mean, I think I could stand being teased and being made to cry if you didn't know about it. She gives me a steady look, as though evaluating how much truth I can handle. I can't just pretend my day was fine with you as a witness to what really happened. Sometimes it makes me not like you. That's not fair, I exclaim. She shrugs. I know. That's why I'm telling you. But what Cardin said to me doesn't matter, and I want to pretend it didn't happen. So I need you to pretend along with me. No reminders, no questions, no cautions. Stung, I stand and walk to her fireplace mantle, leaning my head against the carved stone. I can't count the number of times she's told me that messing with Cardin and his friends is stupid. And yet, given what she's saying now, whatever made her cry this afternoon has nothing to do with me. Which means she's gotten into some kind of trouble, all on her own. Taryn might have a lot of advice to give, but I'm not sure she's taking all of it. So what do you want me to do? I ask. I want you to fix things with him, she says. Prince Cardin's got all the power. There's no winning against him. No matter how brave or clever or even cruel you are, Jude. End this. Before you get really hurt. I look at her uncomprehendingly. Avoiding Cardin's wrath now seems impossible. That ship has sailed and burned up in the harbor. I can't, I tell her. You heard what Prince Cardin said by the river. He just wants you to give up. It's a blow to his pride, and it hurts his status, you acting like you're not afraid of him. She takes my arm at the wrist, pulling me close. I can smell the sharp scent of herbs on her breath. Tell him that he's won and you've lost. They're just words. You don't have to mean them. I shake my head. Don't fight him tomorrow, she continues. I'm not withdrawing from the tournament, I tell her. Even if it wins you nothing but more woe? She asks. Even then, I say. Do something else, she insists. Find a way. Fix it before it's too late. I think of all the things she won't say, all the things I wish I knew. But since she wants me to pretend everything is fine, all I can do is swallow my questions and leave her to her fire. In my room, I find my tournament outfit spread out on my bed, scented with verbena and lavender. It's a slightly padded tunic stitched with metallic thread. The pattern is of a crescent moon turned on its side like a cup, with a droplet of red falling from one corner and a dagger beneath the hole. Maddox crest. I cannot put on that tunic tomorrow and fail, not without bringing disgrace on my household. And although embarrassing Maddox might give me a contrary pleasure, a small revenge for denying me knighthood, I'd embarrass myself too. What I should do is go back to keeping my head down. Be decent, but not memorable. Let Cardin and his friends show off. Save up my skill to surprise the court when Maddox gives me permission to seek a knighthood. If that ever happens. That's what I should do. I knock the tunic to the floor and climb under the coverlets, pulling them up over my head so that I am slightly smothered, so that I can breathe in my own warm breath. I fall asleep like that. In the afternoon when I rise, the garment is wrinkled, and I have no one to blame but myself. You are a foolish child, Tatterfell says, scraping my hair into tight warrior braids. With a memory like that of a sparrow. On my way to the kitchens, I pass Maddox in the hall. He is dressed all in green, his mouth pulled into a grim line.
Hold a moment, he says.
I do. He frowns.
I know what it is to be young and hungry for glory.
I bite my lip and say nothing. After all, he hasn't asked me a question. We stand there, watching each other. His cat eyes narrow. There are so many unsaid things between us. So many reasons we can only be something like father and daughter, but never fully inhabit our roles.
You will come to understand. This is for the best,
he says finally.
Enjoy your battle.
I make a deep bow and head for the door. My trip to the kitchen's abandoned. All I want to do is get away from the house, from the reminder that there is no place for me at the court. No place for me in Faerie.
What you lack is nothing to do with experience.
The summer tournament is being held on the edge of a cliff in Innsweil, the Isle of Woe. It's far enough that I take a mount, a pale gray horse stabled beside a toad. The toad watches me with golden eyes as I saddle the mare and throw myself up onto her back. I arrive at the grounds out of sorts, slightly late, anxious, and hungry. A crowd is already gathering around the tented box where the High King Eldred and the rest of the royals will sit. Long cream-colored banners whip through the air, flying Eldred's symbol, a tree that is half white flowers and half thorns, roots dangling beneath it and a crown atop. The uniting of the Seelie courts, the Unseelie courts, and the Wild Fae under one crown. The dream of the Greenbrier line. The decadent eldest son, Prince Baelkin, is sprawled in a carved chair, three attendants around him. His sister Princess Rhea, the huntress, sits beside him. Her eyes are all on the potential combatants, readying themselves on the grounds. A wave of panicky frustration comes over me at the sight of her intent expression. I so badly wanted her to choose me to be one of her knights. And though she can't now, a sudden awful fear that I couldn't have impressed her comes over me. Maybe Matic was right. Maybe I lack the instinct for dealing death. If I don't try too hard today, at least I never need to know if I would have been good enough. My group is to go first, because we are the youngest. Still in training, using wooden swords instead of live steel, unlike those who follow us. Bouts of fighting will last the whole day, broken up by bardic performances, a few feats of clever magic, displays of archery, and other skills. I can smell spiced wine in the air, but not yet that other perfume of tournaments, fresh blood. Fand is organizing us into rows, handing out armbands in silver and gold. Her blue skin is even more blazingly cerulean under the bright sky. Her armor is varying shades of blue as well, from oceanic to berry, with her green sash cutting across the breastplate. She will stand out no matter how she fares, which is a calculated risk. If she does well, the audience cannot fail to notice. But she'd better do well. As I approach the other students with their practice swords, I hear my name whispered. Unnerved, I look around, only to realize I am being scrutinized in a new way. Taryn and I are always noticeable, being mortal. But what makes us stand out is also what makes us unworthy of much regard. Today, however, that's not so. The children of Faerie seem to be holding a single indrawn breath, waiting to see what my punishment will be for putting hand on Cardin the day before, waiting to see what I am going to do next. I look across the field at Cardin and his friends, with silver on their arms. Cardin is wearing silver on his chest, too, a plate of gleaming steel that hooks over his shoulders and seems more ornamental than protective. Valerian smirks at me. I do not give him the satisfaction of smirking back. Fan gives me a gold band and tells me where to stand. There are to be 3 rounds in the mock war and 2 sides. Each side has a cloak of hide to protect. One, that of a yellow deer. The other, that of silvery fox fur. I drink some water out of a pewter carafe set out for participants and begin to warm up. My stomach is sour with the lack of food, but I no longer feel hungry. I feel sick, eaten up with nerves. I try to ignore everything but the exercises I move through to limber up my muscles. And then it is time. We troop onto the field and salute the seat of the High King, although Eldred has not yet arrived. The crowd is thinner than it will be closer to sunset. Prince Dane is there, though, with Matic beside him. Princess Elowyn strums a lute thoughtfully. Vivi and Taryn have come to watch, although I see neither Orianna nor Oak. Vivi gestures with a kebab of glistening fruit, making Princess Rhya laugh. Taryn watches me intently, as though trying to warn me with her gaze. Fix it. All through the first battle, I fight defensively. I avoid Cardin. Nor do I come near Nikasia, Valerian, or Locke, even when Valerian knocks Fand to the dirt, even when Valerian rips down our deer hide. Still, I do nothing. Then we are called to the field for the second battle. Cardin walks behind me.
You're docile today. Did your sister admonish you? She desires our approval very much.
One of his booted feet toes the clover-covered ground, kicking up a clod.
I imagine that if I asked, she'd roll with me right here until we turned her white gown green, and then thank me for the honor of my favor.
He smiles, going in for the kill, leaning toward me as if confiding a secret.
Not that I'd be the first to green gown her.
My good intentions evaporate on the wind. My blood is on fire, boiling in my veins. I do not have much power, but here is what I have. I can force his hand. Cardin might want to hurt me, but I can make him want to hurt me worse. We're supposed to play at war. When they call us to our places, I play.
I play as viciously as possible. My practice sword cracks against Cardin's ridiculous chest plate. My shoulder bangs against Valerian's shoulder so hard that he staggers back. I attack again and again, knocking down anyone wearing a silver armband. When the mock war is over, my eye is blackened and both of my knees are skinned, and the gold side has won the second and third battles.
You're no killer,
Maddox said. Right now, I feel that I could be. The crowd applauds, and it is as if I have suddenly woken from a dream. I forgot about them. A pixie tosses flower petals at us. From the stands, Vivi salutes me with a goblet of something as Princess Raya applauds politely. Maddox is no longer in the royal box. Balkan is gone, too. The High King Eldred is there, though, sitting on a slightly elevated platform, speaking with Dane, his expression remote. I start to tremble all over, the adrenaline draining out of me. Courtiers, waiting for better battles, study my bruises and evaluate my prowess. No one seems particularly impressed. I have done my best, have fought my hardest, and it wasn't enough. Maddox didn't even stay to watch. My shoulders slump. Worse, Cardin is waiting for me when I get off the field. I am struck suddenly by his height, by the arrogant sneer he wears like a crown. He would seem like a prince even dressed in rags. Cardin grabs my face, fingers splayed against my neck. His breath is against my cheek. His other hand grabs my hair, winding it into a rope.
Do you know what mortal means? It means born to die. It means deserving of death. That's what you are, what defines you, dying. And yet, here you stand, determined to oppose me even as you rot away from the inside out, you corrupt, corrosive, mortal creature. Tell me how that is. Do you really think you can win against me? Against a prince of faerie?
I swallow hard. No, I say. His black eyes simmer with rage.
So you're not completely lacking in some small amount of animal cunning. Good. Now, beg my forgiveness.
I take a step back and tug, trying to wrench free of his grasp. He holds on to my braid, staring down into my face with hungry eyes and a small, awful smile. Then he opens his hand, letting me stagger free. Individual strands of hair flutter through the air. On the periphery of my vision, I see Taryn standing with Locke, near where other knights are donning their armor. She looks at me pleadingly, as though she is the one who needs to be saved.
Get down on your knees,
Cardin says, looking insufferably pleased with himself. His fury has transmuted into gloating.
Beg. Make it pretty. Flowery. Worthy of me.
The other children of the gentry are standing around in their padded tunics with their practice swords, watching, hoping my downfall will be amusing. This is the show they've been expecting since I stood up to him. This isn't a mock war. This is the real thing. Beg? I echo. For a moment, he looks surprised, but that's quickly replaced by even greater malice.
You defied me. More than once. Your only hope is to throw yourself on my mercy in front of everyone. Do it, or I will keep on hurting you until there is nothing left to hurt.
I think of the dark shapes of the Nixies in the water, and the boy at the revel, howling over his torn wing. I think of Taryn's tear-stained face. I think of how Raya would never have chosen me, of how Maddox didn't even wait to see the conclusion of the battle. There's no shame in surrender. As Taryn said, they're just words. I don't have to mean them. I can lie. I start to lower myself to the ground. This will be over quickly. Every word will taste like bile, and then it will be over. When I open my mouth, though, nothing comes out. I can't do it.
Instead, I shake my head at the thrill running through me at the sheer lunacy of what I'm about to do. It's the thrill of leaping without being able to see the ground below you. Right before you realize, that's called falling. You think because you can humiliate me, you can control me, I say, looking him in those black eyes. Well, I think you're an idiot. Since we started being tutored together, you've gone out of your way to make me feel like I am less than you. And to coddle your ego, I have made myself less. I have made myself small. I have kept my head down. But it wasn't enough to make you leave Taryn and me alone. So I'm not going to do that anymore. I am going to keep on defying you. I'm going to shame you with my defiance. You remind me that I am a mere mortal, and you are a prince of fairy. Well, let me remind you, that means you have much to lose, and I have nothing. You may win in the end. You may ensorcel me, and hurt me, and humiliate me. But I will make sure you lose everything I can take from you on the way down. I promise you this. I throw his own words back at him. This is the least of what I can do. Cardan looks at me as though he's never seen me before. He looks at me as though no one has ever spoken to him like this. Maybe no one has. I turn from him and begin walking, half expecting Cardan to grab my shoulder and throw me to the ground, half expecting him to find the Rowanberry necklace at my throat, snap it, and speak the words that will make me crawl back to him, begging, despite all my big talk. But he says nothing. I feel his gaze on my back, pricking the hairs on my neck. It is all I can do not to run. I dare not look toward Taryn and Locke, but I catch a glimpse of Nikasia staring at me, open-mouthed. Valerian looks furious, his hands fisted at his sides in mute rage. I stagger past the tournament tents to a stone fountain, where I splash my face with water. I bend down, starting to clean the gravel from my knees. My legs feel stiff, and I am shaking all over.
"Are you all right?"
Locke asks, gazing down with his tawny fox eyes. I didn't even hear him behind me. I am not. I am not all right. But he can't know that. And he shouldn't be asking. What do you care? I say, spitting the words out. The way he's looking at me makes me feel more pathetic than ever. He leans against the fountain, letting a slow, lazy smile grow on his mouth.
It's funny, that's all.
Funny? I echo, furious. You think that was funny? He shakes his head, still smiling.
No. It's funny how you get under his skin.
At first, I'm not sure I heard him right. I almost ask whom he's talking about, because I can't quite believe he's admitting that high and mighty Cardan is affected by anything. Like a splinter, I say?
Of iron. No one else bothers him quite the way that you do.
He picks up a towel and wets it. Then kneels down beside me and carefully wipes my face. I suck in a breath when the cold cloth touches the sensitive part of my eye, but he is far gentler than I would have been to myself. His face is solemn and focused on what he's doing. He doesn't seem to notice my studying him. His long face and sharp chin. His curling red-brown hair. The way his eyelashes catch the light. Then he does notice. He's looking at me, and I'm looking back at him, and it's the strangest thing. Because I thought Locke would never notice anyone like me. He is noticing, though. He's smiling like he did that night at the court, as though we shared a secret. He's smiling as if we're sharing another one.
Keep it up,
he says. I wonder at those words. Can he really mean them? As I make my way back to the tournament and my sisters, I can't stop thinking of Cardan's shocked face, nor can I stop considering Locke's smile. I am not altogether sure which is more thrilling, and which more dangerous.
Chapter 10. The rest of the summer tournament goes by in a blur. Swordsfolk go toe-to-toe against one another in single combat, fighting for the honor of impressing the High King and his court. Ogres and foxkin, goblins and gwyllions, all engaged in the deadly dance of battle. After a few rounds, Vivi wants us to push through the crowd and buy more fruit skewers. I keep trying to catch Taryn's eye, but she won't allow it. I want to know if she's angry. I want to ask what Locke said to her when they were standing together, although that might be the exact sort of question she would forbid. But the conversation with Locke couldn't have been the humiliating kind, the kind she tries to pretend away, could it? Not when he practically told me he delighted in Cardin's being brought low. Which makes me think of the other question I can't ask Taryn. Not that I'd be the first to green gown her. Fairies can't lie. Cardin couldn't have said it if he didn't believe it to be true. But why would he think that? Vivi knocks her skewer against mine, bringing me out of my reverie. To our clever Jude, who made the folk remember why they stay in their barrows and hills for fear of mortal ferocity. A tall man with the floppy ears of a rabbit and a mane of walnut-brown hair turns to give Vivi a dirty look. She grins at him. I shake my head, pleased by her toast, even if it's wild exaggeration. Even if I impressed no one but her. Would that Jude was just a bit less clever, Taryn says under her breath. I turn to her, but she has moved away. When we get back to the arena, Princess Raya is readying herself for her bout. She holds a thin sword, very much like a long pin, and stabs at the empty air in preparation for an opponent. Her two lovers call out encouragements. Cardin reemerges in the royal box, wearing loose white linen and a flower crown all of roses. He ignores the High King and Prince Dane and flops down in a chair beside Prince Baelkin, with whom he exchanges a few sharp words that I dearly wish I were close enough to hear. Princess Kalia has arrived for her sister's bout and applauds wildly when Raya walks out onto the clover. Matic never returns. I ride home alone. Vivi heads off with Raya after she wins her bout. They are going hunting in the nearby woods. Taryn agrees to accompany them, but I am too weary and too sore and too on edge. In the kitchens of Maddox's house, I toast cheese over a fire and spread it on bread. Sitting on the stoop with that and a mug of tea, I watch the sun go down as I eat my lunch. The cook, a trow named Waddle, ignores me and continues magicking the parsnips to chop themselves. When I am done, I brush crumbs from my cheeks and head for my room. Narbonne, a servant with long ears and a tail that drags on the ground, stops in the hall when he sees me. He's carrying a tray of thimble-sized acorn cups and a silvery decanter of what smells like blackberry wine in his large clawed hands. His livery is pulled tight across his chest, and pieces of fur stick out of the gaps.
Oh, you are at home,
he says, a growl in his voice that makes him seem menacing no matter how benign the words he speaks. Despite myself, I can't help thinking of the guard who bit off the tip of my finger. Narbonne's teeth could snap off my whole hand. I nod.
The prince is asking for you downstairs.
Cardin? Here? My heartbeat speeds. I can't think. Where? Narbonne looks surprised by my reaction.
In Maddox's study. I was just bringing him this.
I grab the tray out of his hands and head down the stairs, intent on getting rid of Cardin as quickly as I can. Any way that I can. The last thing I need is for Maddox to overhear my being disrespectful and decide I'll never belong at the court. He is a servant of the Greenbrier line, sworn as surely as anyone. He would not like my being at odds with even the least of the princes. I fly down the stairs and kick open the door to Maddox's study. The knob crashes into a bookshelf as I stride into the room, plunking down the tray with enough force to make the cups dance. Prince Dane has several books lying open on the library table in front of him. Golden curls fall over his eyes, and the collar of his pale blue doublet is open, showing a heavy silver torque at his throat. I halt, aware of the colossal mistake I have made. He raises both eyebrows.
Jude, I didn't expect you to be in such a rush.
I sink into a low bow and hope he will think me only clumsy. Fear gnaws at me, sharp and sudden. Could Cardin have sent him? Is he here to punish me for my insolence? I can think of no other reason that honored and honorable Prince Dane, soon to be the ruler of Faerie, would ask for me. I say, panic tripping my tongue. With relief, I remember the tray and indicate the decanter. Here, this is for you, my lord. He picks up an acorn and pours a little of the thick black liquid into the cup.
Will you drink with me?
I shake my head, feeling completely out of my depth. It will go straight to my head. That makes him laugh.
Well then, keep me company a time.
Of course. That I cannot possibly refuse. Alighting on an arm of one of the green leather chairs, I feel my heart thud dully. May I get you anything else? I ask, not sure how to proceed. He lifts his acorn cup as if in salute.
I have refreshment enough. What I require is conversation. Perhaps you can tell me what made you storm in here. Who did you think I was?
No one, I say quickly. My thumb rubs over my ring finger, over the smooth skin of the missing tip. He sits up straighter, as though I am suddenly much more interesting.
I thought maybe one of my brothers was bothering you.
I shake my head. Nothing like that.
It's shocking,
he says, as though he's giving me some great compliment.
I know humans can lie, but to watch you do it is incredible. Do it again.
I feel my face heat.
Do it again,
he repeats gently.
Don't be afraid.
Only a fool wouldn't be, despite his words. Prince Dane came here when Maddock was not at home. He asked for me specifically. He implied he knew about Cardin. Perhaps he glimpsed us after the mock war, Cardin jerking my head by my braid. But what does Dane want? I am breathing too shallowly, too fast. Dane, about to be crowned the High King, has the power to grant me a place in the court. The power to gainsay Maddock and make me a knight. If only I could impress him, he could give me everything I want. Everything I thought I lost my shot at. I draw myself up and look into the silvered gray of his eyes. My name is Jude Duarte. I was born on November 13th, 2001. My favorite color is green. I like fog and sad ballads and chocolate-covered raisins. I can't swim. Now tell me, which part was the lie? Did I lie at all? Because what's so great about lying is the not knowing. I realize abruptly that he might not take any vow particularly seriously from me after that little performance. He looks pleased, though, smiling at me as if he'd found a rough ruby lying in the dirt.
Now,
he says,
tell me how your father uses that little talent of yours.
I blink, confused.
Really? He doesn't? What a shame.
The prince tilts his head to study me.
Tell me what you dream of, Jude Duarte, if that's your true name. Tell me what you want.
My heart hammers in my chest, and I feel a little lightheaded, a little dizzy. Surely it can't be this easy. Prince Dane, soon to be the High King of all Faerie, asking me what I want. I barely dare answer. And yet I must. I want to be your knight, I stammer. His eyebrows go up.
Unexpected,
he says.
And pleasing. What else?
I don't understand. I twist my hands together so he can't see how they are shaking.
Desire is an odd thing. As soon as it's sated, it transmutes. If we receive golden thread, we desire the golden needle. And so, Jude Duarte, I am asking you what you would want next if I made you part of my company.
To serve you, I say, still confused. To pledge my sword to the crown. He waves off my answer.
No. Tell me what you want. Ask me for something. Something you've never asked from anyone.
Make me no longer mortal, I think. And then I'm horrified at myself. I don't want to want that. Especially because there is no way to get it. I will never be one of the folk. I take a deep breath. If I could ask him for any boon, what would it be? I understand the danger, of course. Once I tell him, he is going to try to strike a bargain. And fairy bargains seldom favor the mortal. But the potential for power dangles before me. My thoughts go to the necklace at my throat. The sting of my own palm against my cheek. The sound of Oak's laughter. I think of Cardan.
See what we can do with a few words? We can enchant you to run around on all fours, barking like a dog. We can curse you to wither away for want of a song you'll never hear again, or a kind word from my lips.
To resist enchantment, I say, trying to will myself to stillness, trying not to fidget. I want to seem like a serious person who makes serious bargains. He regards me steadily.
You already have true sight, given to you as a child. Surely you understand our ways. You know the charms. Salt our food, and you destroy any ensorcelment on it. Turn your stockings inside out, and you will never find yourself led astray. Keep your pockets full of dried rowan berries, and your mind won't be influenced.
The last few days have shown me how woefully inadequate those protections are. What happens when they turn out my pockets? What happens when they rip my stockings? What happens when they scatter my salt in the dirt? He regards me thoughtfully.
Come closer, child,
he says. I hesitate. From all I have observed of Prince Dane, he has always seemed like a creature of honor. But what I have observed is painfully little.
Come now, if you are going to serve me, you must trust me.
He is leaning forward in the chair. I notice the small horns just above his brow, parting his hair on either side of his regal face. I notice the strength in his arms and the signet ring gleaming on one long-fingered hand, carved with the symbol of the green briar line. I slide from the chair arm and walk over to where he sits. I force myself to speak. I didn't mean to be disrespectful. He touches a bruise on my cheek, one I hadn't realized was there. I flinch, but I don't move away from him.
Cardan is a spoiled child. It is well known in the court that he squanders his lineage on drink and petty squabbles. No, don't bother to object.
I don't. I wonder how it was that Narbonne came to tell me only that a prince was waiting for me downstairs. But not which prince. I wonder if Dane told him to give me that specific message. A well-seasoned strategist waits for the right opportunity.
Although we are brothers, we are very different from each other. I will never be cruel to you for the sake of delighting in it. If you swear yourself into my service, you will find yourself rewarded. But what I want you for is not knighthood.
My heart sinks. It was too much to believe that a prince of fairy had dropped by to make all my dreams come true. But it was nice while it lasted. Then what do you want?
Nothing you haven't already offered. You wanted to give me your oath and your sword. I accept. I need someone who can lie. Someone with ambition. Spy for me. Join my court of shadows. I can make you powerful beyond what you might ever hope. It's not easy for humans to be here with us, but I could make it easier for you.
I allow myself to sink into a chair. It feels a little bit like expecting a proposal of marriage, only to get offered the role of mistress. A spy, a sneak, a liar and a thief. Of course that's what he thinks of me, of mortals. Of course that's what he thinks I'm good for. I consider the spies I have seen, like the parsnip-nosed and hunched figure Maddox consults with sometimes, or a shadowy, gray-shrouded figure whose face I've never managed to spot. All the royals probably have them, but doubtless part of their skill is in how well hidden they are. And I would be well hidden indeed. Hidden in plain sight.
It is perhaps not the future you imagined for yourself, Prince Dane says. No shining armor or riding into battle, but I promise you that once I am the High King, if you serve well, you will be able to do as you like. For who can gainsay the High King? And I will put a gesh on you. A gesh of protection from enchantment.
I go very still. Usually given to mortals in exchange for their service, geshes grant power, with a kick-in-the-teeth exception that comes upon you when you least expect it. Like, you're invulnerable, except to an arrow made of the heartwood of a hawthorn tree, which just so happens to be the exact kind of arrow that your worst enemy favors. Or you'll win every battle you're in, but you're not allowed to refuse invitations to dinner. So if someone invites you to dinner right before a battle, you're not going to be able to show up for that fight. Basically, like everything about fairy, geshes are awesome. And also they suck. Yet, it seems like that is what I am being offered. A gesh? I echo. His smile widens, and after a moment, I know why. I haven't said no, which means I am thinking of saying yes.
No gesh can save you from the effects of our fruits and poisons. Think carefully. I could grant you the power to enrapture all who looked upon you instead. I could give you a spot right there.
He touches my forehead.
And anyone who saw it would be struck with love. I could give you a magical blade that cuts through starlight.
I don't want to be controlled, I say. My voice a whisper. I can't believe I'm saying this out loud, to him. I can't believe I am doing this. Magically, I mean. Give me that, and I will manage the rest. He nods once.
So you accept.
It's frightening to have a choice like this in front of me. A choice that changes all future choices. I want power so badly, and this is an opportunity for it. A terrifying and slightly insulting opportunity. But also an intriguing one. Would I have made a good knight? I have no way of knowing. Maybe I would have hated it. Maybe it would have meant standing around in armor and going on dull quests. Maybe it would have meant fighting people I liked. I nod, and hope I make a good spy. Prince Dane rises and touches my shoulder. I feel the shock of the contact, like a spark of static.
Jude Duarte, daughter of Clay. From this day forward, no fairy glamour will addle your mind. No enchantment will move your body against your will. None save for that of the maker of this gesh. Now no one will be able to control you, he says,
and then pauses for a moment.
Except for me.
I suck in a breath. Of course there's a sting in the tail of this bargain. I cannot even be angry with him. I should have guessed. And yet, it is still thrilling to have any protection at all. Prince Dane is only one fairy, and he has seen something in me. Something Maddox wouldn't see. Something I have yearned to have acknowledged. Right then and there, I go down on one knee on the ancient rug in Maddox's study and swear myself into Prince Dane's service. Chapter 11. All night, as I sit through dinner, I am conscious of the secret I hold. It makes me feel, for the first time, as though I have a power of my own. A power Matic cannot take from me, even thinking of it for too long. I am a spy. I am Prince Dane's spy. Gives me a thrill. We eat little birds stuffed with barley and wild ramps, their skins crackling with fat and honey. Oriana delicately picks hers apart. Oak chews on the skin. Matic does not bother to separate off the flesh, eating bones and all. I poke at the stewed parsnips. Although Taryn is at the table, Vivi has not returned. I suspect that hunting with Raya was a ruse, and that she has gone to the mortal world after a brief ride through the woods. I wonder if she ate her dinner with Heather's family.
You did well at the tenement,
Matic says between bites. I do not point out that he left the grounds. He couldn't have been too impressed. I'm not even sure how much he actually saw. Does that mean you've changed your mind? Something in my voice makes him stop chewing and regard me with narrowed eyes.
About knighthood?
He asks.
No. Once there is a new High King in place, we will discuss your future.
My mouth curves into a secretive smile. As you wish. Down the table, Taryn watches Oriana and tries to copy her movements with the little bird. She does not look my way, even when she asks me to pass her a carafe of water. She can't keep me from following her to her room when we're done, though. Look, I say on the stairs. I tried to do what you wanted, but I couldn't, and I don't want you to hate me for it. It's my life. She turns around. Your life to squander? Yes, I say as we come to the landing. I cannot tell her about Prince Dane, but even if I could, I am not sure it would help. I am not sure at all she'd approve of that either. Our lives are the only real thing we have, our only coin. We get to buy what we want with them. Taryn rolls her eyes. Her voice is acid. Isn't that pretty? Did you make it up yourself? What's the matter with you? I demand. She shakes her head. Nothing. Nothing. Maybe it would be better if I thought the way that you do. Never mind, Jude. You really were good out there. Thanks, I say, frowning in confusion. I wonder again over Cardin's words about her, but I do not want to repeat them and make her feel bad. So have you fallen in love yet? I ask. All my question gets me is a strange look. I am staying home from the lecture tomorrow, Taryn says. I guess it is your life to squander, but I don't have to watch. My feet feel like lead as I make my way to the palace, over ground strewn with windfall apples, their golden scent blowing in the air. I am wearing a long black dress with gold cuffs and a lacing of green braid, a comfortable favorite. Afternoon birdsong trills above me, making me smile. I let myself have a brief fantasy of Prince Dane's coronation, of me dancing with a grinning lock while Cardin is dragged away and thrown in a dark oubliette. A flash of white startles me from my thoughts. It's a stag, a white stag, standing not 10 feet from where I am. His antlers are threaded with a few thin cobwebs, and his coat is a white so bright that it seems silver in the afternoon light. We regard each other for a long moment, before he races off in the direction of the palace, taking my breath with him. I decide to believe this is a good omen. And, at least at first, it seems to be. Classes aren't too bad. Noggle, our instructor, is a kind but odd old Fyr Dearg from up north, with huge eyebrows, a long beard into which he occasionally shoves pens or scraps of paper, and a tendency to maunder on about meteor storms and their meanings. As afternoon turns to evening, he has us counting falling stars, which is a dull but relaxing task. I lie back on my blanket and stare up at the night sky. The only downside is that it is hard for me to note down numbers in the dark. Usually, glowing orbs hang from the trees
or large concentrations of fireflies light our lessons. I carry extra stubs of candles for when even that is too dim, since human eyesight isn't nearly as keen as theirs. But I'm not allowed to light them when we study the stars. I try to write legibly and not get ink all over my fingers.
"Remember," Noggle says, "unusual celestial events often presage important political changes. So with a new king on the horizon, it's important for us to observe the signs carefully."
Some giggling rises out of the darkness.
"Nikasia,"
our instructor says,
"is there some difficulty?"
Her haughty voice is unrepentant.
"None at all."
"Now, what can you tell me about falling stars? What would be the meaning of a shower of them in the last hour of a night?"
"A dozen births," Nikasia says,
which is wrong enough to make me wince. "Deaths," I say under my breath. Noggle hears me, unfortunately.
"Very good, Jude. I am glad someone has been paying attention. Now, who would like to tell me when those deaths are most likely to occur?"
There is no point in my holding back, not when I made a declaration that I was going to shame Cardin with my greatness. I better start being great. It depends on which of the constellations they passed through and in which direction the stars fell, I say. Halfway through answering, I feel like my throat is going to close up. I am suddenly glad of the dark, so I don't have to see Cardin's expression.
Or Nikasia's.
"Excellent," Noggle says. "Which is why our notes must be thorough. Continue."
"This is dull,"
I hear Valyrian drawl.
"Prophecy is for hags and small folk. We should be learning things of a more noble mien. If I am going to pass a night on my back, then I'd wish to be lessened in love."
Some of the others laugh.
"Very well," said Noggle. "Tell me what event might portend success in love."
"A girl taking off her dress," he says to more laughter.
"Elga?"
Noggle calls on a girl with silver hair and a laugh like shattering glass.
"Can you answer for him? Perhaps he's had such little success in love that he truly doesn't know."
She begins to stammer. I suspect she knows the answer, but doesn't want to court Valyrian's ire.
"Shall I ask Jude again?" Noggle asks tartly. "Or perhaps Cardin. Why don't you tell us?"
"No," he says.
"What was that?"
Noggle asks. When Cardin speaks, his voice rings with sinister authority.
"It is as Valyrian says. This lesson is boring. You will light the lamps and begin another, more worthy one."
Noggle pauses for a long moment.
"Yes, my prince,"
he says finally, and all the globes around us flare to life. I blink several times as my eyes try to adjust. I wonder if Cardin has ever had to do anything he didn't want to. I guess it is no surprise that he drowses during lectures. No surprise that he once, drunk as anything, rode a horse across the grass while we were having classes, trampling blankets and books and sending everyone scrambling to get out of his way. He can change our curriculum on a whim. How can anything matter to someone like that?
"Her eyesight is so poor," Nikasia says, and I realize she's standing over me.
She has my notebook and waves it around so everyone can see my scrawls.
"Poor, poor Jude. It's so hard to overcome so many disadvantages."
There's ink all over my fingers and on the golden cuffs of my dress. Across the grove, Cardin is talking with Valyrian. Only Locke is watching us, his expression troubled. Noggle is flipping through a stack of thick, dusty books, probably trying to come up with a lesson that Cardin will like. "Sorry if you can't read my handwriting," I say, grabbing the notebook. The page tears, leaving most of my night's work shredded. But that's not exactly my disadvantage. Nikasia slaps me in the face. I stumble, shocked, suddenly down on one knee,
barely catching myself before I go sprawling. My cheek is hot, stinging. My head rings. "You can't do that," I say to her nonsensically. I thought I understood how this game worked. I thought wrong.
"I may do whatever I wish," she informs me, still haughty.
Our classmates stare. Elga has one delicate hand over her mouth. Cardin looks over, and I can tell from his expression that she has failed to please him. Embarrassment starts to creep over Nikasia's face. For as long as I have been among them, there were lines they didn't cross. When they shoved us into the river, no one witnessed it. For better or worse, I am part of the general's household and under Maddox's protection. Cardin might dare to cross him, but I thought the others would at least strike in secret. I seem to have angered Nikasia past caring about any of that. I brush myself off. "Are you calling me out? Because then it's my right to choose the time and the weapon." How I would love to knock her down. She realizes that my question actually demands a response. I might be lower than the ground, but that doesn't absolve her from obligations to her own honor. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Cardin coming toward us. Jittery anticipation commingles with dread. On my other side, Valerian bumps my shoulder. I take a step away from him, but not fast enough to avoid being assailed with the smell of overripe fruit. Above us, in the black dome of night, 7 stars fall, streaking gloriously across the sky before guttering out. I look up automatically, too late to have seen their precise path.
"Did anyone note that down?"
Noggle begins shouting, fumbling in his beard for a pen.
"This is the celestial event we've been waiting for. Someone must have seen the exact origin point. Quickly, set down everything you can remember."
Just then, as I am looking at the stars, Valerian shoves something soft against my mouth. An apple, sweet and rotten at the same time. Honeyed juice running over my tongue, tasting of sunlight, and pure, heady, stupid joy. Fairy fruit, which muddles the mind, which makes humans crave it enough to starve themselves for another taste, which makes us pliant and suggestible and ridiculous. Dane's Gesh protected me from enchantment, from anyone's control, but fairy fruit puts you out of even your own control.
Oh no. Oh no, 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 no.
I spit it out. The apple rolls in the dirt, but I can already feel it working on me. Salt, I think, fumbling for my basket. Salt is what I need. Salt is the antidote. It will clear the fog in my head. Nikasia sees what I am going for and snatches up my basket, dancing out of the way, while Valerian pushes me to the ground. I try to crawl away from him, but he pins me, shoving the filthy apple back into my face.
"Let me sweeten that sour tongue of yours," he says, pressing it down.
Pulp is in my mouth and up my nose. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. My eyes are open, staring up at Valerian's face. I'm choking. He's watching me with an expression of mild curiosity, as though he's looking forward to seeing what happens next. Darkness is creeping in at the edges of my vision. I am choking to death. The worst part is the joy blooming inside me from the fruit, blotting out the terror. Everything is beautiful. My vision is swimming. I reach up to claw at Valerian's face, but I am too dizzy to reach him. A moment later, it doesn't matter. I don't want to hurt him. Not when I am so happy.
"Do something," someone says. But in my delirium, I can't tell who is speaking.
Abruptly, Valerian is kicked off me. I roll onto my side, coughing. Cardin is looming there. Tears and snot are running down my face, but all I can do is lie in the dirt and spit out pieces of sweet, fleshy pulp. I have no idea why I am crying.
"Enough," Cardin says.
He has an odd, wild expression on his face, and a muscle is jumping in his jaw. I start to laugh. Valerian looks mutinous.
Ruin my fun, will you?
For a moment, I think they're going to fight, although I cannot think why. Then I see what Cardin's got in his hand. The salt from my basket. The antidote.
Why did I want that, I wonder?
He tosses it up into the air with a laugh, and I watch it scatter with the wind. Then he looks at Valerian, mouth curling.
What's wrong with you, Valerian? If she dies, your little prank is over before it begins.
I'm not going to die, I say, because I don't want them to worry. I feel fine. I feel better than I have ever felt in my entire life. I'm glad the antidote is gone.
Prince Cardin,
Noggle says.
She ought to be taken home. Everyone is so dull today,
Cardin says, but he doesn't sound as if he's bored. He sounds as if he's barely keeping his temper in check.
Oh, Noggle, she doesn't wish to go.
Nikasia comes over to me and strokes my cheek.
Do you, pretty thing?
The cloying taste of honey is in my mouth. I feel light. I am unwinding. I am unfurling like a banner.
I'd like to stay, I say,
because here is wondrous. Because she is dazzling. I'm not sure I feel good, but I know I feel great. Everything is wondrous, even Cardin. I didn't like him before, but that seems silly. I give him a wide, happy grin, although he doesn't smile in return. I don't take it personally. Noggle turns away from us, muttering something about the general and foolishness, and princes getting their heads removed from their shoulders. Cardin watches him go, hands fisting at his sides. A knot of girls flop down in the moss beside me. They're laughing, which makes me laugh again, too.
I've never seen a mortal take the fruits of Elfheim before,
one of them, Flossflower, says to another.
Will she remember this?
Would that someone would enchant her to do otherwise,
Locke says from somewhere behind me. But he doesn't sound angry like Cardin. He sounds nice. I turn toward him, and he touches my shoulder. I lean into the warmth of his skin. Nikasia laughs.
She wouldn't want that. What she'd like is another bite of apple.
My mouth waters at the memory. I recall them strewn across my path, golden and glittering, on the way to school, and curse my foolishness for not stopping to eat my fill.
So we can ask her things?
Another girl, Miragna, wants to know. Embarrassing things? And she'll answer?
Why should she find anything embarrassing when she's among friends?
Nikasia says, eyes slitted. She looks like a cat that has eaten all the cream and is ready for a nap in the sun.
Which one of us would you most like to kiss?
Flossflower demands, coming closer. She's barely spoken to me before. I'm glad she wants to be friends.
I'd like to kiss all of you, I say,
which makes them scream with laughter. I grin up at the stars.
You're wearing too many clothes,
Nikasia says, frowning at my skirts.
And they've grown dirty. You should take them off.
My dress does seem abruptly heavy. I imagine myself naked in the moonlight, my skin turned as silvery as the leaves above us. I stand. Everything feels as if it's going a bit sideways. I start pulling off my clothes.
You're right, I say, delighted.
My gown slides into a puddle of cloth that I can easily step out of. I am wearing mortal underclothes, a mint and black polka-dotted bra and underpants. They're all staring at me oddly, as though wondering where I got my underwear. All of them so resplendent that it is difficult for me to look too long without my head hurting. I am conscious of the softness of my body, of the calluses on my hands, and of the sway of my breasts. I am conscious of the soft tickle of grass underneath my feet and the warm earth.
Am I beautiful like you are? I ask Nikasia, genuinely curious. No, she says, darting a look toward Valerian. She picks up something from the ground. You are nothing like us. I am sorry to hear it, but not surprised. Beside them, anyone might as well be a shadow, a blurry reflection of a reflection. Valerian points to the rowan necklace that dangles around my throat, dried red berries threaded onto a long silver chain.
You should take that off, too.
I nod conspiratorially. You're right, I say. I don't need it anymore. Nikasia smiles, holding up the golden thing she has in her hand. The filthy, mashed remains of the apple. Come lick my hands clean. You don't mind, do you? But you have to do it on your knees. Gasping and tittering spread through our classmates like a breeze. They want me to do it. I want to make them happy. I want everyone to be as happy as I am. And I do want another taste of the fruit. I begin to crawl toward Nikasia.
No,
Cardin says, stepping in front of me, his voice ringing and a little unsteady. The others back off, giving him room. He toes off his soft leather shoe and puts one pale foot directly in front of me.
Jude will come here and kiss my foot. She said she wanted to kiss us. And I am her prince, after all.
I laugh again. Honestly, I don't know why I laughed so infrequently before. Everything is marvelous and ridiculous. Looking up at Cardin, though, something strikes me wrong. His eyes are glittering with fury and desire and maybe even shame. A moment later, he blinks, and it's just his usual chilly arrogance.
Well, be quick about it, he says impatiently. Kiss my foot and tell me how great I am. Tell me how much you admire me. Enough, Locke says sharply to Cardin.
He's got his hands on my shoulders and is pulling me roughly to my feet.
I'm taking her home. Are you now?
Cardin asks him, eyebrows raised.
Interesting timing. You like the savor of a little humiliation, just not too much. I hate it when you get like this,
Locke says under his breath. Cardin pulls a pin from his coat, a glittering filigree thing in the shape of an acorn with an oak leaf behind it. For a delirious moment, I think he's going to give it to Locke in exchange for leaving me there. That seems impossible, even to my wild mind. Then Cardin takes hold of my hand, which seems even less possible. His fingers are overwarm against my skin. He stabs the point of his pin into my thumb. Ow! I say, pulling away from him and putting the injured digit into my mouth. My own blood is metallic against my tongue.
Have a nice walk home, he tells me.
Locke guides me away, stopping to grab up someone's blanket, which he wraps around my shoulders. Fairies are staring at us as we pass out of the grove, me stumbling, him holding me up. The few teachers I see do not meet my gaze. I suck on my injured thumb, feeling odd. My head is still swimming, but not like it was. Something's wrong. A moment later, I realize what. There's salt in my human blood. My stomach lurches. I look back at Cardin, who is laughing with Valerian and Nikasia. Miragna is on his arm. Another of our lecturers, a sinewy elf woman from an island to the east, is trying to begin her talk. I hate them. I hate them all so much. For a moment, there is only that. The heat of my fury, turning my every thought to ash. With shaking hands, I clutch the blanket more tightly around my shoulders and let Locke lead me into the woods. I owe you a debt, I grit out after we walk for a little while, for getting me out of there. He gives me an appraising look. I am struck all over again by how handsome he is, by the soft curls falling around his face. It's awful to be alone with him, knowing he's seen me in my underwear and crawling around on the ground.
but I am too angry for embarrassment. He shakes his head.
You don't owe anyone anything, Jude. Especially not today.
How can you stand them? I ask, fury making me turn on Locke, even though he's the only one I'm not mad at. They're horrible. They're monsters.
He doesn't answer me. We walk along, and when I come to the patch of windfall apples, I kick one so hard it ricochets off the trunk of an elm tree.
There is a pleasure in being with them, he says. Taking what we wish, indulging in every terrible thought. There's safety in being awful.
Because at least they're not terrible to you, I ask.
Again, he does not answer. When we get close to Maddox's estate, I stop.
I should go alone from here.
I give him a smile that probably wavers a little bit.
It's hard to keep it on my face.
Wait,
he says, taking a step toward me.
I want to see you again.
I groan, too exasperated for surprise. I am standing here in a borrowed blanket, boots, and mall-bought underwear. I am smeared in soil, and I have just made a fool of myself.
Why?
He looks at me as though he sees something else entirely. There's an intensity in his gaze that makes me stand up a little straighter, despite the dirt.
Because you're like a story that hasn't happened yet. Because I want to see what you will do. I want to be part of the unfolding of the tale.
I'm not sure if that's a compliment or not, but I guess I'll take it. He lifts my hand, the same one Cardin stabbed with the pin, and kisses the very tips of my fingers.
Until tomorrow, he says, making a bow.
And so, in that borrowed blanket, boots, and mall-bought underwear, I walk on by myself, heading for home.
Tell me, who did this?
Maddox insists over and over again. But I won't. He stomps around, explaining in detail how he will find the fairies responsible and destroy them. He will rip out their hearts. He will cut off their heads and mount them on the roof of our house as a warning to others. I know it's not me he's threatening, but it's still me he's yelling at. When I am scared, I can't forget that no matter how well he plays the role of father, he will always and forever also be my father's murderer. I don't say anything. I think about how Oriana was afraid that Taryn or I would misbehave at the court and cause Maddox embarrassment. Now I wonder if she was more worried about how he'd react if something did happen. Cutting off Valyrian's and Acacia's heads is bad politics. Hurting Cardin amounts to treason. I did it myself, I say finally, to make this stop. I saw the fruit, and it looked good, so I ate it.
How could you be so foolish?
Oriana says, whirling around. She doesn't look surprised. She looks as though I am confirming her worst suspicions.
Jude, you know better.
I wanted to have fun. It's supposed to be fun, I tell her, playing the disobedient daughter for all it's worth. And it was. It was like a beautiful dream.
Be quiet,
Maddox shouts, shocking us both into silence.
Both of you, quiet.
I cringe involuntarily.
Jude, stop trying to annoy Oriana,
he says, giving me an exasperated look I am not sure he's ever given me before. But he has turned it on Vivi plenty. He knows I'm lying.
And Oriana, don't be so gullible.
When she realizes what he means, a small delicate hand comes up to cover her mouth.
When I find out whom you're protecting,
he tells me,
they will be sorry they ever drew breath.
This is not helping, I say, leaning back in my chair. He kneels down in front of me and takes my hand in his rough green fingers. He must be able to feel how I am trembling. He lets out a long sigh, probably discarding more threats.
Then tell me what will help, Jude. Tell me, and I will do it.
I wonder what would happen if I said the words. Nikasia humiliated me. Valerian tried to murder me. They did it to impress Prince Cardan, who hates me. I am scared of them. I am more scared of them than I am of you, and you terrify me. Make them stop. Make them leave me alone. But I won't. Maddox's anger is fathomless. I have seen it in my mother's blood on the kitchen floor. Once summoned, it cannot be called back. What if he murdered Cardan? What if he killed them all? His answer to so many problems is bloodshed. If they were dead, their parents would demand satisfaction. The wrath of the High King would fall on him. I would be worse off than I am now, and Maddox would likely be dead. Teach me more, I say instead. More strategy. More blade work. Teach me everything you know. Prince Dane may want me for a spy, but that doesn't mean giving up my sword. Maddox looks impressed, and Orianna annoyed. I can tell she thinks that I am manipulating him and that I am doing a good job of it.
Very well, he says with a sigh. Tatterfell will bring you dinner, unless you feel up to joining us at the dining table. We will begin a more intensive training tomorrow.
I'll eat upstairs, I say, and head to my room, still wrapped in someone else's blanket. On the way, I pass Taryn's closed door. Part of me wants to go in, fling myself on her bed, and weep. I want her to hold me and tell me that there wasn't anything I could have done differently. I want her to tell me that I am brave and that she loves me. But since I'm not sure that's what she'd do, I pass her door by. My room has been tidied while I was gone. My bed made and my windows opened to let in the night air. And there, on the foot of my bed, is a folded-up dress of homespun with the royal crest that servants of the princes and princesses wear. Sitting on the balcony is the owl-faced Hob. It preens a bit, ruffling its feathers. You, I say. You're one of his.
Go to Hollow Hall tomorrow, sweetmeat,
it chirps, cutting me off.
Find us a secret the king won't like. Find treason.
Hollow Hall. That's the home of Baelkin, the eldest prince. I have my first assignment from the Court of Shadows. Chapter 12. I go to sleep early, and when I wake, it is full dark. My head hurts, maybe from sleeping too long, and my body aches. I must have slept with all my muscles tensed. The lectures of that day have already begun. It doesn't matter. I'm not going. Tatterfell has left me a tray with coffee on it, spiced with cinnamon and cloves and a little bit of pepper. I pour a cup. It's lukewarm, which means it has been there for a while. There's toast, too, which softens up when I dunk it a few times. Then I wash my face, which is still sticky with pulp, and then the rest of me. I brush my hair roughly, and then I pull it into a bun by knotting it around a twig. I refuse to think about what happened the day before. I refuse to think about anything but today and my mission for Prince Dane. Go to Hollow Hall. Find us a secret the king won't like. Find treason. So Dane wants me to help ensure that Baelkin isn't chosen to be the next High King. Eldred can choose any of his children for the throne, but he favors the three eldest. Baelkin, Dane, and Elowyn. And Dane above the others. I wonder if spies help keep it that way. If I can be good at this, then Dane will give me power when he ascends the throne. And after yesterday, I crave it. I crave it like I craved the taste of fairy fruit. I put on the servant's dress without any of my mall-acquired underclothes to make sure I am as authentic as possible. For shoes, I dig out a pair of old leather slippers from the back of my closet. They have a hole through the toe that I tried to fix nearly a year ago, but my sewing skills are poor, and I wound up just making them ugly.
They fit, though, and all my other shoes are too beautifully made. We do not have human servants at Maddox's estate, but I have seen them in other parts of Faerie. Human midwives to deliver babies from human consorts. Human artisans cursed or blessed with tempting skill. Human wet nurses to suckle sickly fairy infants. Little human changelings raised in fairy, but not educated with the gentry, as we are.
Cheerful magic seekers who don't mind a little drudgery in exchange for some wish of their heart.
When our paths cross, I try to talk to them. Sometimes they want to, and sometimes they don't. Most non-artisans have been at least slightly glamored to smooth out their memories. They think they're in a hospital or at a rich person's house. And when they're returned home, and Maddox has assured me that they are, they're paid well and even given gifts, such as good luck or shiny hair or a knack for guessing the right lotto numbers. But I know there are also humans who make bad bargains or offend the wrong fairy, and who are not treated so well. Taryn and I hear things, even if no one means for us to. Stories of humans sleeping on stone floors and eating refuse, believing themselves to be resting on feather beds and supping on delicacies. Humans drugged out of their minds on fairy fruit. Balekin's servants are rumored to be the latter, ill-favored and worse-treated. I shudder at the thought of it. And yet, I can see why a mortal would make a useful spy, beyond the ability to lie. A mortal can pass into low places and high without much notice. Holding a harp, we're bards. In homespun, we're servants. In gowns, we're wives with squalling goblin children. I guess being beneath notice has advantages. Next, I pack a leather bag with a shift and a knife, throw a thick velvet cloak over my dress, and descend the stairs. The coffee churns in my gut. I am almost to the door when I see Vivi seated on the tapestry-covered window seat.
"You're up," she says, standing. "Good. Do you want to shoot things? I've got arrows."
"Maybe later." I keep my cloak clutched tightly around me and try to move past her, keeping a blandly happy expression on my face.
It doesn't work. Her arm shoots out to block me. "Taryn told me what you said to the prince at the tournament," she says. "And Oriana told me how you came home last night. I can guess the rest."
"I don't need another lecture," I say to her. "This mission from Dane is the only thing keeping me from being haunted by what happened the day before. I don't want to lose focus. I'm afraid that if I do, I will lose my composure, too."
"Taryn feels awful," Vivi says.
"Yeah," I say. "Sometimes it sucks to be right."
"Stop it."
She grabs for my arm, looking at me with her split-pupiled eyes.
"You can talk to me. You can trust me. What's going on?"
"Nothing," I say. "I made a mistake. I got angry. I wanted to prove something. It was stupid."
"Was it because of what I said?"
Her fingers are gripping my arm hard. "The folk are going to keep treating you like crap." "Vivi, there's no way my deciding to mess up my life is your fault," I tell her. "But I will make them regret crossing me."
"Wait, what do you mean?" Vivi asks.
"I don't know," I say, pulling free. I head toward the door, and this time, she doesn't stop me. Once I'm out, I rush across the lawn to the stables. I know I am not being fair to Vivi, who hasn't done anything. She just wanted to help. Maybe I don't know how to be a good sister anymore. At the stables, I have to stop and lean against a wall while I take deep breaths. For more than half my life, I've been fighting down panic. Maybe it's not the best thing for a constant rattle of nerves to seem normal, even necessary. But at this point, I wouldn't know how to live without it. The most important thing is to impress Prince Dane. I can't let Cardan and his friends take that from me.
To get to Hollow Hall, I decide to take one of the toads, since only the gentry ride silver-shod horses. Although a servant would probably not have a mount of any kind, at least the toad is less conspicuous. I saddle and bridle a spotted one and lead her out onto the grass. Her long tongue lashes one of her golden eyes, making me take an involuntary step back. I hook my foot in the stirrup and swing up onto the seat. With one hand, I pull on the reins, and with the other, I pat the soft, cool skin of her back. The spotted toad launches us into the air, and I hang on. Hollow Hall is a stone manor with a tall, crooked tower, the whole thing half covered in vines and ivy. There's a balcony on the second floor that seems to have a rail of thick roots in place of iron. A curtain of thinner tendrils hangs down from it, like a scraggly beard clotted with dirt. There is something misshapen about the estate that ought to make it charming, but instead makes it ominous. I tie up the toad, stuff my cloak into her saddlebags, and start toward the side of the manor, where I believe I will find a servant's door. On the way, I stop to pick up mushrooms, so it will seem as though I had a reason for being out in the woods. As I get close, my heart speeds anew. Vailkin won't hurt me, I tell myself. Even if I'm caught, he'll simply turn me over to Matic. Nothing bad is going to happen. I'm not entirely sure that's true, but I manage to persuade myself enough to approach the servant's entrance and slip inside. A hallway goes to the kitchens, where I deposit the mushrooms on a table beside a brace of bloody rabbits, a pigeon pie, a bouquet of garlic scapes and rosemary, a few cloudy-skinned plums, and dozens of bottles of wine. A troll stirs a large pot alongside a winged pixie, and cutting up vegetables are two sunken-cheeked humans, a boy and a girl, both of them with small, stupid smiles on their faces and glazed-over looks in their eyes. They don't even look down as they chop, and I'm surprised they don't cut off their own fingers by accident. Worse, if they did, I am not sure they'd notice. I think of how I felt yesterday, and the echo of fairy fruit comes unbidden into my mouth. I feel my gorge rise, and I hurry past, down the hall. I am stopped by a pale-eyed fairy guard, who grabs my arm. I look up at him, hoping I can school my expression to be as blank and pleasant and dreamy as that of the mortals in the kitchens.
I haven't seen you before,
he tells me, making it an accusation. You're lovely, I say, trying to sound odd and a little confused. Pretty eye mirrors. He makes a disgusted sound, which I guess means I am doing a good enough job of pretending to be an ensorcelled human servant, although I feel I went weird and over the top in my nervousness. I am not as good at improvising as I had hoped I would be.
Are you new?
He asks, saying the word slowly. New? I echo, trying to figure out what someone brought here might think about the experience. I cannot stop remembering the sickly sweet taste of fairy fruit on my tongue, but instead of getting me deeper into character, I just want to throw up. Before, I was somewhere else, I blurt out. But now, I have to clean the great hall with polish until every inch of it shines.
Well, I guess you best then,
he says, letting me go. I try to control the shudder building up under my skin. I don't flatter myself that my acting convinced him. He was convinced because I'm human, and he expects humans to be servants. Again, I can see why Prince Dane thought I would be useful. After the guard, it is fairly easy to move around Hollow Hall. There are dozens of humans drifting through their chores, lost in sickly dreams. They sing little songs to themselves and whisper words out loud, but it's obviously just snatches of a conversation happening in their dreams. Their eyes are shadowed, their mouths chapped. No wonder the guard thought I was new. Besides the servants, however, are the Fae. guests of some fete that seems to have ebbed rather than ended. They sleep in various states of undress, draped over couches, and entwined on the floors of the parlors I pass through, their mouths stained gold with Nevermore, a glittering golden powder so concentrated that it stupefies fairies and gives mortals the ability to glamour one another. Goblets lie on their side, mead pooling to run over the uneven floor like tributaries into great honey wine lakes. Some of the folk are so still, I worry that they have debauched themselves into death. "Excuse me," I say to a girl about my age carrying a tin bucket. She passes me without even seeming to notice I have spoken. With no idea what else to do, I decide to follow. We pad up a wide stone staircase without rails. Three more of the folk lie in a dissipated stupor beside a thimble-sized bottle of spirits. Above, from the other end of the hall, I hear an odd cry, like someone in pain. Something heavy hits the ground. Rattled, I try to school my face back to dreamy nonchalance. But it isn't easy. My heart beats like a trapped bird. The girl opens a door to a bedroom suite, and I slip in behind her. The walls are stone and hung with no paintings or tapestries. A massive half-tester bed takes up most of the space in the first room. The headboard panel carved with various animals with women's heads and bare breasts. Owls and snakes and foxes, doing some kind of weird dance. I guess I shouldn't be surprised, since Baelkin heads the profligate Circle of Grackles. The books piled up on the wooden desk are ones I recognize, the same books Taryn and I study for our classes. These are spread out, with a few pieces of paper scattered over the wood between them, beside an open inkpot. One of the books has careful notations along one side, while the other is covered in blots. A broken pen, snapped in half deliberately, or at least I can't think of a way it could have happened that's not deliberate, is lying in the hinge of the ink-stained book. Nothing that looks treasonous. Prince Dane gifted me the uniform, knowing I could walk in as I had done. He was counting on my ability to lie for the rest. But now that I am inside, I hope there is something in Hollow Hall to find. Which means that no matter how frightened I am, I must pay attention. Along the wall are more books, some of them familiar from Maddox's library. I pause in front of a shelf, frowning, and kneel down. Stuffed into a corner is a copy of a book I know but didn't expect to see here in this place. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, bound together in one volume. Mom read to us from one a lot like that back in the mortal world. Opening the book, I see the familiar illustrations, and then the words. "But I don't want to go among mad people," Alice remarked. "Oh, you can't help that," said the cat. "We're all mad here. I'm mad. You're mad." "How do you know I'm mad?" said Alice. "You must be," said the cat, "or you wouldn't have come here." A bubble of scary laughter threatens to rise up my throat, and I have to bite my cheek to keep it from coming. The human girl is kneeling in front of a huge fireplace, sweeping up ash from the grate. The andirons, shaped like enormous curling serpents, flank her, their glass eyes ready to glow with lit flames. Although it's ridiculous, I can't bear to put the book back. It isn't one Vivi packed, and I haven't seen it since my mother read it at bedtime. I stuff it down the front of my dress. Then I go to the wardrobe and open it, seeking some clue, some valuable piece of information. But as soon as I look inside, a wild panic starts in my chest. I am instantly sure whose room I am in. Those are Prince Cardin's extravagant doublets and breeches, Prince Cardin's gaudy fur-edged capelets and spider silk shirts. Done sweeping up ash in the fireplace, the servant girl stacks new wood into a pyramid with aromatic pine for kindling resting on top. I want to push by her and run from Hollow Hall.
I had assumed that Cardin lived in the palace with his father, the High King. It didn't occur to me that he might live with one of his brothers. I remember Dane and Baelkin drinking together at the last court revel. I hoped desperately that this wasn't arranged to humiliate me further, to give Cardin another excuse, or worse, opportunity, to punish me more. I will not believe it. Prince Dane, about to be crowned the High King, does not have time to indulge in the petty sport of pretending to take me into his service just because a callow younger brother wishes it. He would not set a gesh on me or bargain with me just for that. I must continue to believe it, because the alternative is too awful. All this means is that besides Prince Baelkin, I must avoid Prince Cardin on my way through the house. Either of them might recognize me if they glimpsed my face. I must make sure they do not glimpse it. Probably they will not look too closely. No one looks too closely at human servants. Realizing I am not so different, I force myself to notice the pattern of moles on the human girl's skin and split ends of her blonde hair, and the roughness of her knees. I watch how she sways a little as she pushes to her feet. Her body's clearly exhausted, even if her brain doesn't know it. If I see her again, I want to know I would recognize her. But it does no good, and does no spell. She continues her tasks, smiling the same awful, contented smile. When she leaves the room, I head in the opposite direction. I must find Baelkin's private rooms, find his secrets, and then get out. I open doors carefully, peering inside. I discover two bedrooms, both under a thick layer of dust. One with a figure lying under a cobwebby shroud on the bed. I pause for a moment, trying to decide if it's a statue, or a corpse, or even some kind of living thing. Then I realize this has nothing to do with my mission and back out quickly. I open another door to find several fairies twined together on a bed, asleep. One of them blinks drowsily at me, and I catch my breath, but he just slumps back down. The seventh room enters into a hallway, with stairs spiraling up and up into what must be the tower. I take them quickly, my heart racing, my leather shoes soft on the stone. The circular room I come to is paneled in bookshelves, filled with manuscripts, scrolls, golden daggers, thin glass vials with jewel-colored liquids inside, and the skull of some deer-like creature with massive antlers supporting thin taper candles. Two large chairs rest near the only window. There's a huge table dominating the middle of the room. On it are maps weighed down on the corners by chunks of glass and metal objects. Beneath them is correspondence. I shuffle through the papers until I come to this letter. I know the provenance of the blusher mushroom that you ask after. But what you do with it must not be tied to me. After this, I consider my debt paid. Let my name be stricken from your lips. Although the letter is unsigned, the writing is in an elegant feminine hand. It seems important. Could it be the proof Dane is looking for? Might it be useful enough to please him? And yet, I cannot possibly take it. If it were to go missing, then Baelkin would know for certain that someone had been here. I find a sheet of blank paper and press it over the note. As quickly as I can, I trace the letter, trying to capture the precise hand in which it was written. I am almost done when I hear a sound. People are coming up the stairs. I panic. There's nowhere to hide. There's practically nothing, even in the room. It's mostly open space, exempting the shelves. I fold up the note, knowing it's unfinished, knowing the fresh ink will smear. As quickly as I can, I scuttle underneath one of the large leather chairs, folding myself into a tight ball. I wish I'd left the stupid book where I'd found it, because one sharp corner of the cover is digging into my underarm. I wonder what I was thinking, believing myself clever enough to be a spy in fairyland. I squeeze my eyes shut, as though somehow not seeing whoever is coming into the room will keep them from seeing me.
I hope you've been practicing,
Bilkin says. My eyes open into slits. Cardin is standing beside the bookshelves, a bland-faced male servant holding a court sword with gold engraving along the hilt and metal wings making the shape of the guard. I have to bite my tongue to keep from making some sound.
Must we?
Cardin asks. He sounds bored.
Show me what you've learned.
Bilkin lifts a single staff from a vessel beside his desk that holds an assortment of staves and canes.
All you have to do is get a single hidden. Just one, little brother.
Cardin just stands there.
Pick up the sword.
Bilkin's patience is worn thin already. With a long, suffering sigh, Cardin lifts the blade. His stance is terrible. I can see why Bilkin is annoyed. Surely Cardin must have been given fighting tutors since he was old enough to hold a stick in his hands. I was taught from the time I got to Faerie, so he'd have had years on me. And the first thing I learned was where to put my feet. Bilkin raises his staff.
Now, attack.
For a long moment, they stand still, regarding each other. Cardin swings his sword in a desultory manner, and Bilkin brings down his staff hard, smacking him in the side of the head. I wince at the sound of the wood against his skull. Cardin staggers forward, baring his teeth. His cheek and one of his ears is red, all the way to the point.
This is ridiculous,
Cardin says, spitting on the floor.
Why must we play this silly game? Or do you like this part? Is this what makes it fun for you? Swordplay isn't a game.
Bilkin swings again. Cardin tries to jump back, but the staff catches at the edge of his thigh. Cardin winces, bringing up his sword defensively.
Then why call it swordplay?
Bilkin's face darkens, and his grip on the staff tightens. This time he jabs Cardin in the stomach, striking suddenly and with enough force for Cardin to sprawl on the stone floor.
I have tried to improve you, but you insist on wasting your talents on revels, on being drunk under the moonlight, on your thoughtless rivalries and your pathetic romances.
Cardin pushes himself to his feet and rushes at his brother, swinging his sword wildly. He wields it like a club. The sheer frenzy of the attack makes Bilkin fall back a step. Cardin's technique finally shows. He becomes more deliberate, attacking from new angles. He's never shown much interest in swordsmanship at school, and although he knows the basics, I am not sure he practices. Bilkin disarms him ruthlessly and efficiently. Cardin's sword flies from his hand, clattering across the floor toward me. I scuttle back deeper into the shadows of the chair. For a moment, I think that I am going to be caught. But the servant is the one to pick up the blade, and his gaze does not waver. Bilkin cracks his staff against the back of Cardin's legs, sending him to the ground. I am delighted. There's a part of me that wishes I were the one wielding that staff.
Don't bother to rise.
Bilkin unbuckles his belt and hands it over to the servant. The human man wraps it twice around his palm.
You have failed the test. Again.
Cardin doesn't speak. His eyes are glittering with a familiar rage, but for once, it isn't directed at me. He's on his knees, but he doesn't appear in any way cowed.
Tell me.
Belkin's voice has gone silky, and he paces around his younger brother.
When will you cease being a disappointment? Maybe when you stop pretending that you don't do this for your own pleasure,
Cardin answers.
If you want to hurt me,
It would save us both a lot of time if you got right down to...
Father was old and his seed weak when he sired you. That's why you're weak.
Bilkin puts one hand on his brother's neck. It looks affectionate until I see Cardin's flinch, the shifting of his balance. That's when I realize Bilkin is pressing down hard, pinning Cardin in place on the floor.
Now, take off your shirt and receive your punishment.
Cardin begins to strip off his shirt, showing an expanse of moon-pale skin and a back with a delicate tracery of faded scars. My stomach lurches. They're going to beat him. I should be glorying in seeing Cardin like this. I should be glad that his life sucks, maybe worse than mine, even though he's a prince of faerie and a horrible jerk and probably going to live forever. If someone had told me that I'd get an opportunity to see this, I would have thought the only thing I'd have to stifle was applause. But watching, I cannot help observing that beneath his defiance is fear. I know what it is to say the clever thing because you don't want anyone to know how scared you are. It doesn't make me like him any better, but for the first time, he seems real. Not good, but real. Bilkin nods. The servant strikes twice, the slap of the leather echoing loudly in the still air of the room.
I don't order this because I am angry with you, brother,
Bilkin tells Cardin, causing me to shudder.
I do it because I love you. I do it because I love our family.
When the servant lifts his arm to strike a third time, Cardin lunges for his blade, resting on Bailkin's desk where the servant put it. For a moment, I think Cardin is going to run the human man straight through. The servant does not cry out or lift his hands to protect himself. Maybe he is too ensorcelled for that. Maybe Cardin could stab him right through the heart and he wouldn't do a single thing to defend himself. I am weak with horror.
Go ahead,
Bilkin says, bored. He makes a vague gesture toward the servant.
Kill him. Show me you don't mind making a mess. Show me that at least you know how to land a killing blow on such a pathetic target as this.
I am no murderer, says Cardin,
surprising me. I would not have thought that was something to be proud of. In two strides, Bilkin is in front of his brother. They look so alike, standing close. Same inky hair, matching sneers, devouring eyes. But Bilkin shows his decades of experience, wrenching the sword from Cardin's hands and knocking him to the ground with the crossbar.
Then take your punishment like the pathetic creature that you are.
Bilkin nods to the servant, who rouses from somnolence. I watch every blow, every flinch. I have little choice. I can shut my eyes, but the sounds are just terrible. And worst of all is Cardin's empty face, his eyes as dull as lead. Truly, he has come by his cruelty honestly in Bailkin's care. He has been raised up in it, instructed in its nuances, honed through its application. However horrible Cardin might be, I now see what he might become, and am truly afraid.
Chapter 13. Disturbingly, it is even easier to gain entrance to the palace of Elfheim in my servant's gown than it was to enter Bailkin's household. Everyone, from goblin to the gentry, to the High King's mortal court poet and seneschal, fairly gives me a passing look as I find my clumsy way through the labyrinthine halls. I am nothing. No one. A messenger no more worthy of attention than an animated twig woman or an owl. My pleasant, placid expression, combined with forward momentum, gets me to Prince Dane's chambers without so much as a second look. Even though I lose my way twice and have to retrace my steps.
I rap on his door, and I'm relieved when the prince himself opens it. He raises both brows, taking in the sight of me in the homespun dress. I make a formal curtsy, as any servant might. I do not alter my expression, for fear of his not being alone.
"Yes?"
he asks. "I am here with a message for you, Your Highness," I say, hoping that sounds right. "I beg for a moment of your time."
"You're a natural,"
he tells me, grinning.
"Come inside."
It's a relief to relax my face. I drop the inane smile as I follow him into his parlor. Furnished in elaborate velvets, silks, and brocades, it's a riot of scarlet and deep blues and greens. Everything rich and dark, like overripe fruit. The patterns on the material are the sorts of things I have become accustomed to. Intricate braids of briars. Leaves that might also be spiders when you looked at them from another angle. And a depiction of a hunt where it is unclear which of the creatures is hunting the other. I sigh and sit down in the chair he is pointing me toward, fumbling in my pocket. "Here," I say, drawing out the folded-up note and smoothing it against the top of a cunning little table with carved bird feet for legs. He came in while I was copying it, so it's kind of a mess. I had left the stolen book with the toad. The last thing I want Prince Dane to know is that I took something for myself. Dane squints to see the shapes of the letters past my smudges.
"And he didn't see you?"
"He was distracted," I say truthfully. "I hid." He nods and rings a small bell, probably to summon a servant. I will be glad of anyone not ensorcelled.
"Good. And did you enjoy it?"
I am not sure what to make of that question. I was frightened pretty much the whole time. How is that enjoyable? But the longer I think about it, the more I realize that I did sort of enjoy it. Most of my life is dreadful anticipation, awaiting for the other shoe to drop. At home, in classes, with the court, being afraid I would be caught spying was an entirely new sensation. One where I felt, at least as though I knew exactly what to be scared of. I knew what it would take to win. Sneaking through Balekin's house had been less frightening than some revels. At least until I'd watched Cardin get beaten. Then I'd felt something I don't want to examine too closely. "I liked doing a good job," I say, finally finding an honest answer. That makes Dane nod. He's about to tell me something else when another fairy enters the room. A male goblin, scarred, his skin the green of ponds. His nose is long and twists fully around before bending back toward his face like a scythe. His hair is a black tuft at the very crown of his head. His eyes are unreadable. He blinks several times, as though trying to focus on me.
"They call me the Roach," he says,
his voice melodious, completely at odds with his face. He bows and then cocks the side of his head toward Dane.
"At his service. I guess we both are. You're the new girl, right?"
I nod. Am I supposed to tell you my name, or am I supposed to come up with something clever? The Roach grins, which twists his whole face up even more hideously.
"I am supposed to take you to meet the troop. And don't worry about what we're going to call you. We decide that for ourselves. You think anyone in their right mind would want to be called the Roach?"
"Great," I say, and sigh. He gives me a long look.
"Yeah, I can see how that's a real talent. Not having to say what you mean."
He's dressed in an imitation of a court doublet, except his doublet is made from scraps of leather. I wonder what Matic would say if he knew where I was and with whom. I do not think he would be pleased. I don't think he'd be pleased by anything I did today. Soldiers have a peculiar kind of honor. Even those who dip their caps in the blood of their enemies, sneaking around houses and stealing papers, is not at all in line with it. Even though Matic has spies of his own, I don't think he'd like my being one.
So he's been blackmailing Queen Orla,
Dane says, and the Roach and I look over at him. Prince Dane is frowning over the letter, and suddenly I understand. He recognizes my copy of the handwriting. Nicasia's mother, Queen Orla, must be the woman who obtained poison for Baelkin. She wrote that she was repaying a debt. Although knowing Nicasia, I would guess a little nastiness wouldn't give her mother much pause. But the Queen of the Underseas Kingdom is vast and mighty. It is hard to imagine what Baelkin could have over her. Dane hands my letter to the Roach.
So do you still believe he will use it before the coronation?
The goblin's nose quivers.
That's the smart move. Once the crown is on your head, nothing's going to get it off.
Until that moment, I hadn't been sure whom the poison was for. I opened my mouth and then bite the side of my cheek to stop myself from saying something foolish. Of course it must be for Prince Dane. Whom else would Baelkin need some special poison to kill? If he were going to put regular people to death, he'd probably use some kind of cheap, regular person poison. Dane seems to notice my surprise.
We have never gotten along, my brother and I. He has always been too ambitious for that. And yet, I had hoped.
He waves his hand around, dismissing whatever he was about to say.
Poison may be a coward's weapon, but it is an effective one.
What about Princess Elowen? I ask. And then wish I could take back the question. Poison for her, too, probably. Queen Orla must have a cartload of it. This time, Dane doesn't answer me.
Maybe Baelkin plans on marrying her,
the Roach says, surprising us both. At our expressions, he shrugs.
What? If he makes things too obvious, he's going to be the next one to get a knife in the back. And he wouldn't be the first member of the gentry to wed a sister.
If he marries her,
Dane says, laughing for the first time in this conversation.
He'll get a knife in the front.
I had always thought of Elowen as the gentle sister. Again, I am aware of how little I really know about the world I am trying to navigate.
Come, says the Roach,
waving me to my feet.
It's time you met the others.
I cast a plaintive look in Dane's direction. I don't want to go with the Roach, whom I have just met, and whom I am not at all sure I trust. Even I, who have grown up in the house of a redcap, fear goblins.
Before you go,
Dane walks over until he's standing directly in front of me.
I promised that none might compel you, save for me. I am afraid I'm going to have to use that power. Jude Duarte, I forbid you from speaking aloud about your service to me. I forbid you from putting it into writing or into song. You will never tell anyone of the Roach. You will never tell anyone of any of my spies. You will never reveal their secrets, their meeting places, their safe houses. So long as I live, you will obey this.
I am wearing my necklace of rowan berries, but they are no protection against the magic of the Gesh. This is no regular glamour, no simple sorcery. The weight of the Gesh slams down on me, and I know that if I tried to speak, my mouth wouldn't be able to form those forbidden words. I hate it. It's an awful, out-of-control feeling. It makes me scramble around in my head, trying to imagine my way around his commandment, but I cannot.
I think of my first ride to Faerie, and the sound of Taryn and Vivi wailing. I think of Maddox's grim expression. Jaw locked, doubtlessly unused to children, no less human ones. His ears must have been ringing. He must have wanted us to shut up. It's hard to think anything good about Maddox in that moment, with our parents' heart's blood on his hands. But I will say this for him. He never enchanted away our grief or took our voices. He never did any of the things that might have made the trip easier for him. I try to convince myself that Prince Dane is only doing the smart thing, the necessary thing in binding me. But it makes my skin crawl. For a moment, I am unsure of my decision to serve him.
Oh,
Dane says as I am about to leave.
One more thing. Do you know what Mithridatism is?
I shake my head, not sure I am interested in anything he has to say right now.
Look into it.
He smiles.
That's not a command, only a suggestion.
I follow the roach through the palace, keeping back from him a few steps so it doesn't seem like we're together. We pass a general Maddox knows, and I make sure to keep my head bowed. I don't think he would look closely enough to recognize me, but I cannot be sure. Where are we going? I whisper after several minutes of walking through the halls.
Just a little further,
he says gruffly, opening a cupboard and climbing inside. His eyes reflect orange, like a bear's.
Well, come on, get in and close the door.
I can't see in the dark, I remind him, because that is one of the many things the folk never remember about us. He grunts. I get in, folding myself up tightly so that no part of me touches him, and then I close the cabinet door behind me. I hear the slide of wood and feel the rush of cold, damp air. The scent of wet stone fills the space. His hand on my arm is careful, but I can feel his claws. I let him pull me forward, allow him to press my head so I know when to duck. When I straighten out, I am on a narrow platform above what appears to be the palace's wine cellars. My eyes are still adjusting, but from what I can see, there is a network of passageways worming below the palace. I wonder how many people know about them. I smile at the thought of having a secret about this place. Me, of all people. I wonder if Maddox knows. I bet Cardin doesn't. I grin, wider than before.
Enough gawping?
The roach asks.
I can wait.
Are you ready to tell me anything? I ask him. Like, where we're going, or what's going to happen when we get there?
Figure it out,
he says, the growl in his voice.
Go on.
You said we were going to meet the others, I tell him. Starting with what I know, trying to keep up and avoid stumbling on the uneven ground. And Prince Dane made me promise not to reveal any hidden locations, so obviously we're going to your lair. But that doesn't tell me what we're going to do when we get there.
Maybe we're going to show you secret handshakes,
the roach says. He's doing something I can't quite see. But a moment later, I hear a click, as though a lock was tripped or a trap disarmed. A gentle shove against the small of my back, and I'm heading down a new, even more dimly lit tunnel. I know when we come to a door, because I walk straight into it, much to the roach's amusement.
You really can't see,
he says. I rub my forehead. I told you I couldn't.
Yes. But you're the liar,
he reminds me.
I'm not supposed to believe anything you say.
Why would I lie about something like that? I demand, still annoyed. He lets my question hang in the air. The answer is obvious, so I could retrace my steps. so he might accidentally show me something he wouldn't show someone else, so that he would be incautious. I really need to stop asking stupid questions. And maybe he really needs to be less paranoid, since Dane put a gesh on me so I can't tell anyone no matter what. The roach opens the door. The light floods the hallway, causing me to throw my arm up in front of my face. Blinking, I look into the secret lair of Prince Dane's spies. It's packed earth on all four sides, with walls that curve inward and a rounded ceiling. A large table dominates the room, and sitting at it are two fairies I've never met. Both of them gazing at me, unhappily.
"Welcome," says the roach, "to the Court of Shadows."
Chapter 14. The two other members of Dane's spy troop also have code names. There's the lean, handsome fairy that looks at least part human, who winks and tells me to call him the Ghost. He has sandy-colored hair, which is normal for a mortal, but it is unusual for a fairy, and ears that come to